Support for WKAR is provided by LSJ Media, offering digital marketing solutions to area businesses of all sizes, such as website development, email marketing, optimization, and more. Information at lsjmedia.com. And by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, supporting more than 1,100 businesses in the greater Lansing area for more than 110 years. Information at lansingchamber.org.
Current state here on 90.5 WKAR. Glad you're here. I'm Mark Bayshore. Don't forget, I want to remind you every opportunity I can this hour that we will be taking our program out on the road tomorrow from 11 till 1. We'll be broadcasting live from the East Lansing Arts Festival. We'd love to hear what you make of the show so far. Offer us any feedback you like. We'll be set up outside the East Lansing City Hall on Abbott Road. So we look forward to that a lot. It looks like the weather is going to be pretty decent. We have learned here on Current State that one of Mid-Michigan's most prominent health officials is taking on a new job, or a new tour of duty, as the case may be. Dr. Dean Cinco is the Associate Dean for Prevention and Public Health at the MSU College of Human Medicine. Many people in the Lansing area remember him as the director of the Ingham County Health Department. Dr. Cinco is also a major general in the Army Reserve, and he's now preparing to lead the U.S. Army Public Health Command. It's based at Aberdeen Proving Grounds in Maryland. Dr. Cinco is taking a one-year leave of absence from Michigan State to oversee 3,000 Army employees in more than 100 countries. He'll oversee missions involving environmental health, toxicology, and other studies around the world. Dr. Cinco told us here at Current State that much of what he'll work on in the military also applies in the civilian world.
There's a lot of transferability with what's happening in the civilian world with trying to keep populations healthy, lower health care costs. So I'm excited about the opportunities I will have here to try to shape our policy so that we can keep everyone in the Army family as healthy as possible, so that we can reduce our health care expenditures. And I think that's something certainly I expect to bring back to Michigan State when I return.
Among other things, Dr. Cinco's command oversees all food inspection services for the Department of Defense. Congratulations to Major General and Mid-Michigander Dean Cinco as he heads off to active duty to serve the USA. Republican majorities at the state capitol would like to wrap up a budget in a few weeks. Here in the midst of the process of that always intriguing experience, we're pleased to be joined by a key Mid-Michigan participant, 68th District Democratic State Representative Andy Shore of Lansing. Shore's been active in May, launching and announcing support for measures involving voting reform, women's health, and many other measures. Nice to have you back to Current State, Andy.
It's great to be here, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Where is the budget process right now, in your view, in general, and what concerns you the most?
Well, in terms of process, the budget has passed both chambers and is about to go into conference committee so they can decide the final pieces. The legislature, the House and the Senate, have both passed budgets. The consensus revenue estimating conference, which is an estimate of how much money we actually have, has met and has found that we've got about $500 million more than we thought we did, and another $200 million ongoing money than we thought we did. So there's money to play with that can be used to backfill programs, to pay off debts, to put away in the bank account, a variety of different areas. So the Republicans are in charge in the House and the Senate and the governor's office, and their three leaders will sit down and have those discussions. It'd be nice if they included some of the Democratic leaders, but that's not always the case. And they will try and figure out what to do with that money and how to finalize the budget. We still have a few fairly big outstanding issues. The governor proposed to accept expanded Medicaid dollars to cover 400,000 more people and save the state a ton of money that we're paying right now in uncompensated care when people go to the emergency rooms and don't have health insurance. So that's still hanging out there because the governor proposed it. The Republicans in the House and now the Senate have said no. But we have a bill in the House that we have been taking hours and hours of testimony on, which would sort of accept the money, except it would place lifetime caps on Medicaid recipients. It would require co-pays. It would say that we can only take the money for 3 years. When I say Medicaid recipients, these are people who are making about $15,500 a year and have no health insurance. So we're looking at that in the House.
You're looking at a measure with a 3-year time limit.
It's what the measure says is it says as long as the federal government is paying 100%, then we can accept the money. But you have to have the lifetime caps. You have to have co-pays and other things, which is not allowed under federal law. So the 3-year time limit it reflects the fact that the feds are going to pay 100% for 3 years, and then after that, they slowly ratchet it down to about 90%. The governor has a great plan, actually, he put in where we would accept the money and bank some of it and then pay, use the banked money to pay the amount that Michigan would be responsible for. But the Republicans so far have rejected that plan and put forward their own, saying as long as the feds are going to give us the money, we'll take it, but we're only going to allow people to be on Medicaid for 4 years max, and then they're thrown off and they're on their own. So there's some problems with the plan, but we're having those conversations now in the House.
Let's get to a comment that we heard yesterday on the program. As you pointed out, many Republicans have been calling for more skin in the game, as they say, from any new recipients of an expanded Medicaid program here in Michigan, meaning a more active role in their health, higher co-pays, more involvement in obesity and smoking cessation. Yesterday, here on the program, a local guy you know, Dennis Litos, called for that as well. Mr. Litos is the CEO of the new nonprofit health insurance co-op, Consumers Mutual. Here he is from yesterday.
You know, you need to have skin in the game. And the one thing about the Affordable Care Act and the subsidy program is that individuals have to contribute to their premium. They have to contribute to their out-of-pocket costs. And to the degree to which they are on the lower end of income, they get a little bit more subsidy, in fact, to do that. And on the higher end of income, a little less subsidy. So I think that if you want to design a new Medicaid expansion program to have a little bit more out-of-pocket for the individuals, that will work okay. You know, I think the argument to that is that, you know, if that ends up being additional uncompensated care or bad debts that can't be collected by your health care providers, it creates a bit of a challenge. But I think everybody having skin in the game today is the appropriate thing for health care.
So what struck me about that is that it's not uncommon to hear a politician come down one side or the other, but this was a local, pretty well-established health official calling for more skin in the game. Where is this going?
But, you know, let me talk about what he said first. There is, you know, there are several incentives built into the bill, and there are some co-pays in the federal program. Let's talk about the skin in the game argument. So you're making $15,300 a year. You are working. These are not, you know, people who are not working sitting on their couch eating bonbons. These are working people who are making $15,300 a year. That's the 133%. That's the top end that's covered under Medicaid expansion. The bill that's in front of us right now says you have to pay up to 5% in co-pays. So you're making $15,300 a year. You're, you know, what does that buy you? That buys you food. That buys you some prescription drugs, maybe a pretty beat up car. Now you're going to take from that $15,000, $1,000 that you're paying for health care. You know, that's the skin in the game we're talking about. We're saying your skin in the game is taking food out of your mouth and preventing you from having a car to get to work and things like that. So that's a concern to me, that these are not people who are making a lot of money who have to contribute. These are not people who are sitting there doing nothing. These are people who are working part-time jobs, minimum wage jobs. That's a big concern. Now, you asked where are we? The House has taken two committee meetings of testimony, and we're going to do two more next week. I see some big changes in the bill. You know, the bill right now says basically an able-bodied adult would only have 4 years of coverage, and then they're thrown off. And an able-bodied adult is basically defined as someone who's between the ages of 21 and 65. And I had asked several questions, you know, what does that mean? What about, you know, the sponsor of the bill said they want to come in and they want people who are in bad jobs to get better jobs. And if they're obese and smoking to get into better shape and have muscles instead of fat and all of that. And that's laudable, and I like the idea of the incentives for those things. But what do you do when someone is pregnant? What do you do when someone has diabetes or cancer? You can't work out and get rid of diabetes. You can't work out and not be pregnant and get in better shape. Those people need to be covered also under this Medicaid expansion. And that and the sponsor agreed with me, and we need to work through a lot of those questions. And that's something that I'm hoping that we're going to do over the next, you know, week or two.
Well, one more question on Medicaid expansion. We'll move on because there's so much other stuff to talk about. Is a really flawed Medicaid expansion measure preferable to none at all?
You know, still trying to decide that. The proposal they have right now isn't just really flawed. It's not legal under the federal law. We would need some pretty massive waivers from the Federal Affordable Care Act. And many, we have had a lot of testimony on that. And many think, including the governor's office, the director, Jim Havman, of the department, that he said it's not going to happen. We're not going to get waivers. So if we don't get a waiver, this is just spinning our wheels. We're going through all of this. We're not going to get a waiver from the federal government. And there's going to be no acceptance of the Medicaid expansion. The Republicans would like to blame it on the feds. But the reality is, this is the law. This is what it takes to get this money. So we very likely will not be able to if this is how we pass it, because we won't get a waiver.
Let's move on here. The state treasurer, as you mentioned, the state treasury is now expected to come into $483 million more than anticipated for fiscal year 2013, the one we're in now. This is according to the new revenue projections. How should that money be allocated in your view?
Well, in my view, over the last few years, there have been pretty significant cuts to education. We've seen a new pension tax. We've seen the loss of our homestead credits and a variety of other credits that we've been seeing being able to take on our taxes. In my view, we need to backfill a little bit of that. We need to – our Lansing schools has gone from $7,300 per pupil to $7,100 per pupil in the governor's first 2 years. And when the governor did that, he said, we're gonna make all these cuts, we're going to write the budget, then we're going to reinvest. I would like to see our cities start seeing some money reinvested. You know, we're passing local millages. We have a 4 mil increase in Lansing, but our cities have had 0% increase. I'd like to see our schools receive some backfill in dollars. I think that we need to go back to those that we have cut and say, okay, you've been cut. Now we need to backfill that money in order to show that now that the economy is getting better, we are going to ensure that you're getting the dollars you need for our kids, for our local residents. Look at taking the pension tax off the books, maybe restore some of the credits so that our citizens, our middle class, are not the ones taking the brunt of this. That's what we need to put the money back into.
There are some purposes for which this money could not be used, as I understand it, at least. But everything you've just mentioned, revoking the pension tax, for example, that could be moved on.
We can use it for anything. I mean, the money is general fund money, so we can use it really for anything. The question that really needs to be answered is this one-time money that's only for this year, that's not going to happen next year, or is it continual money? In the last 2 or 3 years, you know, we've seen increases when we've done the consensus revenue conference at the very end of the budget process. So it seems like there is more money in the budget to go around. It will be year to year. The economy is getting better. So it's just a question of, do we want to put money into something one time and risk not having that again next year? Or, you know, do you want to use that to pay down pension debt? Or, you know, I think the some of the Republicans are calling to put it into the rainy day fund when we've already put a significant amount of money in the rainy day fund, and they want to put some more in. Those are the questions that are being thrown around now.
We're talking with Lansing State Rep. Andy Shore of the 68th. Most recently, you've launched a package of bills involving voting reform.
Sure.
What problems do these bills address?
Well, one of the big problems is here in East Lansing. We saw in the last election, a gentleman tried to use a signature stamp when he voted to sign his ballot. Under the current, he's disabled. He's got ALS, got Lou Gehrig's disease. Under the current law, you can't do that. You can put an X on your ballot. You can make your mark, but you can't use a signature stamp with your signature on your ballot. So I introduced a bill that would allow for signature stamps to be able to be used. It's an aid for those who are disabled who at one time could sign and now can't sign. They've got it on file with the clerk and they use their signature stamp. That was brought up in committee, and we had a really good hearing. We had, you know, the clerk of East Lansing there to testify in support. She did a great job. And I can see that bill moving. The second bill I had is a little more controversial. Right now, when you go into a voting booth, if you vote, you go, you put your ballot in the machine, and then you know you want your friend to take a picture of you voting so you can put it up on Facebook. Mm-hmm. That happens a lot. You go to Facebook on election day, and you see all these people, I voted, and pictures in the voting booth. I've seen sitting state representatives now who've had their picture taken. We had the Secretary of State, Ruth Johnson. She did this when she went in to vote, you know, to vote a few years ago. You know, I think the Lieutenant Governor did this. You see a lot of this. Well, it's all illegal. It's all illegal. If you take a picture of yourself anywhere in a poll site voting, and you put it up on Facebook and someone in the Secretary of State's office sees it, they can disallow your vote. They can completely wipe out your vote because it's illegal.
And the Secretary of State did it.
She did it, and then they took it off. Somebody found it and said, you got to take that off, so they took it off.
Okay.
So now that bill has been more controversial because the Secretary of State's office and local clerks are saying that there really is no way to allow for photographs in a poll site because you might accidentally take a picture of someone else and it could violate their rights. So there have been a lot of questions about that. You know, my intention was to allow people to be able to take a picture in a poll site of themselves, but not of their actual ballot. It's seen a lot more questions. And again, the Secretary of State, even though she did this a few years ago, is opposing that bill. As are several of the clerks, so we're going to have some conversation. I'm just trying to figure out a way to take something that people do that's illegal and make it allowed where it makes sense.
Are you prepared for Mark Schauer to announce for governor?
I am. I think Mark is great. I've known him for many years. When he was in the legislature, he was a very thoughtful legislator. He was a great congressman. I think he would be a wonderful gubernatorial candidate if he decides to run.
If the state, you probably followed George Fulton's projections. The U of M economist George Fulton said Wednesday he expects a moderate and broad-based economic recovery to continue in Michigan. If that recovery continues the way George Fulton forecasts, how much harder might it be to vote out Rick Snyder?
I don't know. You know, there's a lot of different pieces to the economy. The federal government assisted our automotive companies, and Michigan has a lot of reliance on automotive jobs and supplemental jobs. You know, it's all political. You know, the Democrats are going to say the economy is getting better because of Barack Obama and not Rick Snyder, and the Republicans are going to say the economy is getting better because of Rick Snyder and not Barack Obama, and it's all political. And we'll all get the mail, and we'll all see the TV ads, and I don't know. I think there are some people who are very upset with the governor out there over some of the things that happened last year and recently. But I'm sure that there will be a very healthy campaign. I'm sure it will start soon. The governor hasn't even announced his intention to run for re-election, although I assume he will. Mm-hmm. It's all part of the campaign.
Democrat Andy Shore represents the 68th state district here. Representing Lansing, we appreciate your stopping by. Thanks, Andy.
Thanks for having me.
It's Current State on WKAR. WKAR radio station manager and Current State contributor Peter Worf takes us now to an MSU campus location where art and science come together.
Patient name is... Have you said the patient name yet? Why don't we just put Stradivarius?
I'm at Mid-Michigan MRI, where many people are examined daily. Today's patient came from Italy and is over 300 years old.
Are we okay broadcasting that the patient is Antonio Stradivarius, or should we just say Antonio S?
Yes, let's leave it at S for just for safety, I guess.
Okay.
The patient is a 1690s violin made by Antonio Stradivarius of Cremona, Italy. Along with violins by a scant handful of other makers, Stradivari's work is the standard by which all violins are measured, instruments prized by concert violinists worldwide. This Strad's owner, who remains anonymous, has come by for a look inside the instrument. Just like with human patients, Mid-Michigan MRI's CAT scanner will reveal the inside of the violin's body without actually opening it up. Dr. Eric Shapiro is research director of the Department of Radiology at Michigan State University.
So today we're going to put the fiddle into the 64-slice CT at the Mid-Michigan MRI. And we will be performing a high-resolution CT scan of this instrument, and we will be digitally taking the top of the violin off to look on the inside.
And what are you looking for? What do you hope to find out after the CT scan?
Well, on a test violin we did last week, we could see very subtle architectural, let's call it imperfections. And so I guess today we'll be looking for damage to the inside of the back of the violin and see what else we can see in the rest of the violin.
As with any other highly valued violin, this Stradivarius comes with a condition report documenting past damage and repairs. The hope is that today's exam will confirm that report and perhaps even reveal more information. Jim Pochin was chairman of radiology at MSU for 37 years, and he joined us for the exam.
I think you'll definitely know what's inside the violin today. And this is something you don't know now.
Yeah.
And you can't take it apart and repair it exactly as it is. You know, non-invasive testing is the way to find out.
Dr. Eric Shapiro, who leads the investigative team, tells us that he's aware of CT scanning applied to other instruments.
A colleague of mine at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, he told me they've done CT of violins before. Not routinely done, but it has been done. And I think when you have access to high tech and you're a bit creative, you can do some interesting things.
Do you know whose violin it was, or is that doctor-patient private information?
I don't know. I don't want to step on anybody's toes. I'm afraid to say.
Okay. Fair enough.
So we head into the room with the CT scanner.
So he's going to line it up so that you'll see the laser lines will sort of do what we call an isocenter. So we'll be the exact center of this particular instrument. And we'll be running this as if we're running a patient here.
Dr. Shapiro immediately notices one of the distinguishing characteristics of the Stradivarius versus a lesser instrument.
Already we can see how thin the wood is on this instrument versus the instrument we ran last week, which was probably 30, 40 years old maybe.
After about 30 minutes of scanning, all past repairs of this 1690s Stradivarius are confirmed, and we discover something new. There are four small wooden pegs used in the construction of this instrument, attaching two crescent-shaped curves that fill out the lower half of the violin's signature hourglass shape. A very unusual feature, but you can only tell from the inside. For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
Coming up on Current State in our second half hour, should Ingham County launch mental health courts? We'll talk with Al Platt, Ingham County Supervisor of Adult Mental Health Services. We're also joined by Genesee County Probate Court Judge Jen Barkey, who's overseen a mental health court in Genesee County for some time, and she will talk about her experience as well. We preview the summer night sky for people who like to look up when they're out outside at night in the Lansing area and try to understand what's up there. Also, a reminder to join Current State tomorrow in downtown East Lansing. Emmanuel Berry, our weekend host, and I will be talking to festival goers and other special guests live here on 90.5 FM. Between 11 and 1 tomorrow, we'll be camped out in front of East Lansing City Hall on Abbott Road. Peter Worf continues hosting classical music after that live from the Art Festival. That's all coming up tomorrow. We hope you can join us, and there's more Current State on the way. I'm Mark Bayshore. its current state here on 90.5 WKAR. You can reach us via email at currentstate@wkar.org. Lots of good emails this week. Keep them coming, and join us tomorrow in front of East Lansing City Hall as we broadcast the show live for a couple of hours between 11 and 1. Earlier this month, a group of House Republican lawmakers introduced a four-bill package that would create a permanent system of mental health treatment courts in Michigan. Currently, there are 16 such courts scattered across the state, many of which were part of a state-funded pilot program that began in 2009. According to a 2012 evaluation of that pilot program from the Michigan Department of Community Health, the courts have had significant success in lowering recidivism rates among participants. Joining me to discuss mental health courts is Genesee County Probate Judge Jenny Barkey. She's presided over one of the first mental health courts in the state. Judge Barkey, good morning.
Good morning.
And also with me is Al Platt. He's the Ingham County Supervisor of Adult Mental Health Services and is leading the effort to establish a local mental health court. Welcome, Al.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Judge Barkey, let's start with you. Tell us how mental health courts, or MHCs as they're abbreviated, how do they work?
Well, basically, what it is people who are mentally ill that as a result of their mental illness commit crimes, instead of going through the usual court system, they come through our program. They're screened by our community mental health representative. The judge who's assigned to the case agrees to it. And instead of going to jail or prison for their offenses, they serve 1 year with me. And they appear every week in front of me. The first thing we do is get them on medication, get them on the right medication, and get them on it consistently. Then we find them places to live, we find them things to do, and they report every week to me. And at the end of the year, if they do everything they're supposed to do, then the charges are ultimately dismissed in some cases. Or this is instead of doing the normal probation, this is like a real super-duper intensive probation with us. And we have found that this works very well for some people. And absolutely, I think Al agrees with me 100%. It's better than the way we have been doing it because our jails and our prisons are filled with people who committed crimes as a result of mental illness. And this just isn't a way to do it.
How does somebody become eligible for the mental health court?
Well, obviously they come in contact with the criminal justice system. And I have a CMH worker that goes into the jail 6 o'clock every morning. And he'll contact me and say, we have one judge or we don't have one judge. And sometimes I'll go into the jail early in the morning, get them before they go to different courts. Or they'll appear in front of a circuit or district court judge, and their attorney will request mental health court instead of the other courts. We've been doing this since 2007. We're the first one in the state. So we have the judges around here pretty well schooled. And a lot of these people are repeat offenders. A lot of the judges know them. A lot of the judges have never had another alternative other than jail and prison, which they really know isn't going to work, but what else are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And they are big proponents of sending people to us.
Al, what's it like here in Ingham County? Are there a considerable number of people with mental health issues that wind up in the Ingham County Jail?
Yes. Mark, I do want to point out, though, first that by far most people who have a mental illness don't end up in the criminal justice system. They're good citizens and follow their program and establish a good recovery and don't have any problems with the law.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a sizable minority of people, because of their mental illness and the difficulty of maintaining a recovery, that do come to the attention of the criminal justice system, are arrested or repeat arrests, as the judge indicates, and end up in the jails and the prison. And we have had this problem, like any other county here in the Lansing area.
Over the course of a year, how many people are we talking about there? Do you have an idea, Al?
Go ahead, Judge.
Just in my program right now, I have 50 active participants. Since 2007, we have seen 292 folks, and out of those, 97 have graduated successfully. But I know that seems, well, that's less than half, but that's better than what we were doing. And plus, I tell them, it's a court of promises. I promise we'll get you on the right medications, da-da-da-da-da. But I also promise, if you do not do what I tell you to do, you're going to go to jail, you're going to go to prison, and I keep that promise. So this is probably a lot more difficult than probation would be.
Al Platt, update us, or continue that thought if you wish.
Okay, yeah, it certainly is a big problem here in Ingham County, too. The important thing to remember about mental health courts, though, it's like a segment or a tool in trying to work on this problem, because the numbers of people who end up in mental health courts is really just a portion of the people who have mental health problems that end up in jails. They have to be willing to participate in the mental health court, and they have to have relatively minor program crime, which the judge can speak to. But there are other people in the jails and prisons who have caused more serious crimes, that have chronic mental illnesses. So it's a very far-reaching problem, and a mental health court is one avenue, one tool to try to address it.
You're trying to work on bringing a mental health court here to Ingham County. I understand you just had a meeting yesterday, in fact. What's involved in the process?
Well, yeah, the process is a long one, and this has started here in Ingham County with us having a series of discussions with some judges in the county and probation officers to identify the mentally ill who are ending up in jails, and we've always provided some treatment for those folks.
Judge Jenny Barkey, tell us a little bit more about the results you've seen. You went into some numbers a minute ago, but tell us more.
It's a team effort. You need to get the prosecutor on board, the judges on board, and that's the sheriff on board. But you know, some of the numbers they gave just for Genesee County, Jail, because of the program, they don't have the recidivism with mentally ill people. And I did the math. They said that we saved 5,000 days of jail time. That's $340,000 in jail costs that have been saved by this program. So when you explain it to people who deal with this population all the time, and jail should be for criminals.
Where does your...
Not for people who commit crimes as a result of criminals. But if you approach it with those kinds of numbers and acquaint people with that, they're more able to jump on board. As far as the kinds of offenses, we'll take felonies, we'll take misdemeanors. I mean, we don't take murder. For some reason, we don't take treason. Criminal sexual conduct, first or third degree, armed robbery, some controlled substance offenses. But anything else, we're pretty open for. It's a case-by-case basis. I have the right to refuse somebody. I don't do it very often. But it's really also a preventative thing. If you can get somebody when they just commit a misdemeanor, get them on a medication routinely, you'll prevent future offenses. And it doesn't work always, but, boy, it beats doing it how we used to.
Jenny, where does the funding come from for the courts in Genesee County?
Well, when we started in 07, we had nothing. We just started it because a lot of what we're doing, a lot of what CMH is doing, the courts are doing, the jails are doing, I mean, we're doing it already. We just focused it in another direction. Then in 2009, we became eligible for a grant through the state, and we used that funding. But you can start one of these programs with absolutely no money because you're doing it already. You just focus your energy.
You are reassigning activities.
Yes.
You're reassigning
yes.
processes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. And hopefully, not having these repeat offenders, saving money in the future.
Yeah. Al Platt.
And here in Ingham County, as the judge said, we're looking at how to allocate our resources so that we can respond to this need and start a process of mental health courts. We spend a lot of time and money serving people in the jail or people who are going in and out of the jail or people who are hospitalized from the jail. And so to focus some of our resources on creating a mental health court, which the studies show will help us reduce those recidivism rates, will allow us to, in the long run, save money and resources as well as really provide a better service for these people.
We're talking with Genesee County Judge Jenny Barkey about Genesee County's mental health court, and we're talking with Al Platt about starting such a court here in Ingham County. There's a couple of concerns that we've heard about that I'd like you to respond to. Jenny Barkey, prosecutorial discretion. Right now it sounds like it's up to the prosecutor to decide whether a defendant is eligible for a mental health court, and this sounds like it could be a problem. An offer to be transferred to the mental health court could be used as a bargaining chip for a plea deal. Can you speak to that?
Well, in the beginning it can be, but it's pretty easy to make your prosecutor a believer. A real prosecutor wants to prosecute criminals, people who commit offenses of their own free volition, all right? Not somebody who beat somebody up because they thought they were having a schizophrenic moment and thought they were a devil monster or something like that. So this frees the prosecutor up to prosecute the real cases they need to prosecute. That's number one. Number two, hopefully, and we try very hard, when we get someone on their medications and get them going in the right direction, we can keep them going on the right track. They'll stay in services, and there won't be repeat offenders. So, yes, the prosecutor is the gatekeeper. Now, after someone pleads in front of the judge can then, after the plea is taken, regardless if the prosecutor likes it or not, just sentence the person to mental health court instead. So in some cases, they're not. But it works better when we work as a team. And with our financial struggles and our political personalities up here, if we can do it in Genesee County, anybody can do it, as long as they're motivated to do the right thing for this population.
Al Platt, it also appears there might be some hesitancy among some mental health care workers to trust the courts, that they worry about excessive punishment, they worry about discrimination. How do you get mental health workers to trust the courts?
Well, you asked a question a little while ago about the process, and the process really involves a lot of discussions with the prosecuting attorney, the judges involved, and also just the mental health agencies and workers who are used to operating in a certain manner. And it takes an open mind to look at it a little differently.
Jenny Barkey is a Genesee County probate judge. Al Platt is the Ingham County Supervisor of Adult Mental Health Services. Thank you both for joining me to talk about mental health courts here in Michigan.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
You're listening to WKAR's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Summer nights mean summer constellations, but if you rested your eyes occasionally during astronomy class, it might be hard to figure out what exactly you're looking for. In fact, it might be hard if you didn't rest your eyes. Current State's Emmanuel Berry joined John French, interim director of the Abrams Planetarium, for a tour of the summer sky. French started with the well-known astronomical asterism. That's the summer triangle.
The summertime stars, probably the most famous summertime constellation group, would be the summer triangle. And it's in the opposite direction of the sun in the summer months. So that means it would be up when the sun is down and down when the sun is up. So we would be able to see it all night long.
So where is the summer triangle
well,
right now?
Well, the summer triangle, let's see, the sky just, I just moved the sky around to 10 o'clock at night, and we're facing towards the north here in the planetarium. So we need to move a little bit later at night, and we should turn around towards the south. So let me push a few buttons here that will move us around. Here we are.
Speeding through time and space right now.
Speeding through time and space, spinning around, looking in the other direction. And if you go outside at 10 o'clock at night right now, the summer triangle is just starting to rise over in the northeastern part of the sky. At 10 o'clock, just two of the three stars of the triangle would be above the horizon, a star called Vega and a star called Deneb. But if we move till maybe about 11 or 12 o'clock at night, then that summer triangle will be a little bit higher up in the sky. So we'll go a little bit later at night, maybe around midnight or so, and look over towards the east.
Now, later in the summer, it rises a little bit earlier as we move around in the in our orbit. And so now the summer triangle in our planetarium sky is above the horizon. And I'm going to draw that using our magic of our planetarium into a nice big triangle. And so we can see it. We have a star called Vega, a star called Deneb, and a star called Altair. Now, the summer triangle is not a constellation, but it is what is referred to as an asterism. An asterism is a recognizable pattern of stars. And what we see here are actually parts of three separate constellations. There's Cygnus the Swan, Lyra the Harp, and Aquila the Eagle that make up that summer triangle. The word constellation has, I guess, two different definitions. There's kind of the casual, everyday definition is that it's a group of stars that makes a picture in the sky. Mm-hmm. But really, to an astronomer, a constellation means an area of the sky. Back about 100 years ago, astronomers divided the sky into 88 different pieces. And each section of the sky is what we call a constellation. So just like a map of the United States is divided up into 50 states, a map of the sky is divided up into constellations. And what I'm displaying right now here in the planetarium is are the boundary lines that separate the sky into these different constellations. And so, of course, because different people have different imaginations, people are going to see different things,
But the map is a set thing.
Right, and it's just an easy way to organize the sky. If there's some new comet that's discovered, one astronomer can tell another where to look by saying, oh, I saw this interesting thing in the constellation of Cygnus the Swan, and then they would know that they're talking about this section of the sky that we call Cygnus.
So what kind of technology, what do you use here to make all this magic happen on the dome here?
Well, the technology that we have is actually fairly old. We have a Digistar star projector. That's the brand name of our star projector, and this is the Digistar 2, and it projects the stars using a computer that shines up into a big fisheye lens that throws the stars up onto the dome. Works great, but we are a little bit concerned because it is getting pretty old. 20-year-old computers, as you can imagine, are kind of old. And we would love to upgrade, but the company is making a Digistar Model 5 nowadays, which we would love to get. And so hopefully one of these days we'll find the funding to be able to upgrade to get a new system.
So what are some other sections of the sky that are unique to summer?
Well, let's see. I guess the low in the south, there are two easy constellations to see. We're going to go to later in the summer or later at night this time of the year. And looking towards the south, there's two constellations, Sagittarius and Scorpius, that are very easy to spot. And they are both part of the zodiac. And the zodiac is just a band of 12 constellations that circle the sky, but what is kind of famous about them is that they lie along the ecliptic, which is the path that the sun and the planets take as they go around the sky. So the planets are always going to be found somewhere within the zodiac constellations. But if you look low towards the south in the summer months, we can see the Scorpion, which looks kind of like a long letter J with the top tilted over a little bit, and it has a bright star in it called Antares. And then Sagittarius is
like a teapot.
A teapot, exactly. Yes, it looks like a teapot, and they call that the teapot of Sagittarius. And one thing that I find fascinating is that the center of our galaxy is just up above the spout of the teapot. We don't see the center of the galaxy because there's just too much dust in outer space. You don't think of space as being dusty, but there are maybe a few dust particles every few miles, but when you have billions of miles, that makes billions of dust, and that dust particles, and that blocks the light. So the center of the galaxy is off in that direction near Sagittarius and Scorpius. And so when you are out on a summer night and you're looking at the sky, if you're camping up in the UP and the moon is not in the sky, you'll be able to see that Milky Way stretching high overhead, and just know that low towards the south is where we would see the center of our galaxy.
Another thing that's really interesting that I think people should watch for, especially this month, we have...
some planets in the sky, right?
We do, yes. We have a little grouping of planets. We have Jupiter and Venus very low in the western sky right now, in the west-northwestern part of the sky. If you go out...
What time would you say? Around what time?
Go out just a little bit after sunset right now, and maybe about 30 minutes after sunset, and you should be able to see Venus and Jupiter. Now, Venus is very low and very close to the horizon, so it'll be a challenge to see, and the sky won't be totally dark yet. Go out, you know, in the early twilight, and maybe if you have binoculars, that might help. You'll see Venus very low on the horizon, and up above that, much easier to see, will be Jupiter. But those two planets, right now, they're maybe about 20 degrees apart, and they're moving closer to each other, and by the end of May, they will pass each other in the sky. And then by the end of the month, Mercury joins them as well. And then we'll have Jupiter and Venus and Mercury all forming a little trio of planets. A trio is what they call it when we have planets within a 5-degree area of the sky. And we won't have that tight of a trio of Venus, Mercury, and Jupiter for at least another 25 years. So if you want to see these three planets all clustered together, watch for them. Later this month, but they will be low and close to the horizon, and you'll want to look with maybe a pair of binoculars because they will be in the evening twilight and very close to the horizon. So also find a good spot with a good view to the horizon. A lot of times there's trees and buildings and things in the way, but we have our publication called the Sky Calendar.
A little bit about the Sky Calendar and how it works.
Yeah, well, we have the publication called the Sky Calendar that shows what's up in the sky on different nights, and it's something that has been published here at the Abrams Planetarium for many years, since probably the late 60s, I believe. On the front of the calendar is the calendar. On the back of it is a star map that shows the whole sky. But the calendar, one of the things we really try to focus on are groupings of planets and alignments of planets, kind of the planetary dance that you see in the sky. And it's always kind of fun to watch how our sky changes throughout the years.
So Saturn is also in the, you can also see that in the summer as well right now?
Yeah, Saturn will be probably the easiest planet to see all summer long. It right now is in the east-southeastern part of the sky in the evening, and it will be more towards the south in the evening later this summer. And I guess one easy way to find Saturn is to use the Big Dipper. The Dipper's handle, if you extend the handle of the Big Dipper, it curves out and points to a bright star called Arcturus. And then if you continue on down in a straight line, you will come to the planet Saturn. That will be visible to us all night long during the summer months and will be very easy to see. And if you have a small telescope, of course, you can see the rings of Saturn, which are always very fascinating.
Well, John, it's been an absolute pleasure stargazing with you around noon today. thank you so much for your time.
Oh, glad to be able to share the night sky with you during the day.
John French is the interim director here at the Abrams Planetarium. This is Emmanuel Berry out under the stars.
Coming up this weekend on Current State, don't forget, on Saturday, tomorrow, we'll be broadcasting live from the East Lansing Art Festival. Current State will be in front of City Hall on Abbott Road, live from 11 to 1 for a special two-hour broadcast. We will talk with art lovers and food vendors and event organizers, East Lansing officials. Be careful, we might be putting a microphone in front of your face while we're at it. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks also to producer Emmanuel Berry, to Aaron Young for engineering, and to Yensia Wong for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.